kick off, thank you. Just to record that overnight, I've issued a minute ask confirming the information that we've requested from Council. Can you give me any idea, Ms. Scott, where your team will be in a position to give us those way-to-earn maps?
I will need to read the minute first. Sorry, I haven't seen it yet, but I will do that while Ms. Turner's reading out her summary.
Appreciate that. Reason obviously being that we'll be talking to the submitters next week about those issues.
Certainly. I'll look at that shortly. Just before we start with Ms. Turner, just one other housekeeping matter. There was a question earlier in the week about the timing of the spatial plan. So I've received some advice from Council. This is subject to the relevant steering group approval, but officers are hoping to be able to consult in Q4 of this year. That has been pushed back in light of the disruption from COVID, and that, as was given in evidence earlier in the week, they're looking at some of the detail within that spatial plan in light of COVID-19. But best intentions at the moment are Q4 for consultation.
I got the impression that they would be consulting about the review of the modelling of the population and employment and all those sorts of things. But is it more than that? They'll be consulting not only on the review of all the modelling work, but also on what that means for the spatial plan.
They will be consulting on our spatial plan.
On our spatial plan, okay.
Yes, essentially a draft plan will go out for consultation with the community.
There was a memo sent round by Anita Lansdowne, who's leading the spatial plan work, and they've just taken it to Otaku and other Runanga UGA ministers and the NZTA board on Kāinga-ora. And the ministerial and agency consultation ends on the 8th of July. So that's another step kicked off. So if it's at the stage of being presented to the ministers, it's at that level of completion. And the best contact is Anita Vanstone. If you get any questions, which I'm sure you will have.
Okay, so Ms. Turner's, you should have two statements from her in front of you, her section 42A and rebuttal, and I handed up a highlight summary yesterday, so hopefully you all have that. I'll ask Ms. Turner to read out her summary.
Good morning, everyone. My evidence covers the recommendations for rezoning of the Arthurs Point North and the consequential changes to the high-density residential chapter. I'd just like to correct an error in my Section 42A report. At paragraph 2.3, it reads 13 submission points and 119 further submission points. And this should instead read 102 original submission points. There was 13 submitters, and just a little bit of error there. Further, in paragraph 11.1, I refer to Arthurs Point Woods Limited Partnership and relief sought.
So there was 11.1?
Yes. This should also have included reference to the submission of QRC Shotover, insofar as they request the same relief for building height in their submission. That's their submission point at 31032.12. And it's the same as Arthurs Point Woods Limited request. Okay. So my recommendation for the zoning of Arthurs Point North is a mixed zoning approach, taking into account the landscape and hazard evidence available, as well as consideration of other positive and adverse economic, social and environmental effects. My recommended zoning and overlays for Arthurs Point North is shown in Figure 9 of my Section 42A report. After receiving evidence, on behalf of submitters, I do not recommend any further amendments to zoning, overlays, or associated provisions of the MDR and HDR zones. I consider that the high-density residential zone is the most appropriate zone for the flat areas of Arthurs Point North, and that the MDR zone, with VA subzones and BR building restriction areas for particular areas that are sloped or and or more visible or have other characteristics that make it more vulnerable to development. I consider that the rural zone is the most appropriate zone for land identified as being part of an O&L. I do not consider that bespoke plan provisions are an efficient or effective way to manage effects when an appropriate existing framework exists for managing the activities. In my Section 42A report, I have recommended a minor amendment to the high-density residential purpose, as it applies to Arthurs Point North only, and the addition of a new policy for Arthurs Point North, which is not already covered by the existing framework. Submitters proposed other amendments to the provisions, including policies related to amenity and rules related to building height and density. I consider these proposals are either already covered by the existing framework or are inappropriate for the Arthurs Point North area. The issues that are still unresolved, there's quite a few, but I've just kind of highlighted the key ones here. So for Arthurs Point Outstanding Natural Landscape Society, the submitter seeks amendments to the urban growth boundary and the outstanding natural landscape boundary locations. Additionally, the submitter requests amendments to the provisions that a medium density residential zone is not adjacent to an O&L boundary. The further extent of the full extent of the relief sought is considered partially out of scope. No landscape evidence was provided by the submitter to support the proposed amendment to the O&L boundary, and I consider that the notified location of the O&L boundary will adequately protect the landscape values at Arthurs Point North, while allowing the already consented lots to be effectively utilised for urban development. I consider that my recommended approach to zoning is consistent with the outcomes sought and the strategic objectives and results in appropriate management of the effects of development on landscape values. For the Robert Stewart submission. Chapter 28 includes objectives and policies that direct hazards to be managed to avoid significantly increasing risks associated with natural hazards and preclude exposing vulnerable activities to hazard risk or creating risks to human life where this is to be deemed to be intolerable. My assessment against Chapter 28 and the greater statutory context of the PORPS and the RMA is that the relief sought is inconsistent with this direction. No assessment was provided against Chapter 28, nor was any evidence in community tolerance of hazard provided by the submitter. Rezoning as requested to medium density residential would include this, indicate that this land would be suitable for urban development. However, based on Mr. Bond's evidence for council, it may not be possible to sufficiently reduce the risk from natural hazards through site-specific design. My recommendation is that the land remains as a rural zone, as this gives a clear indication that urban development is not anticipated and allows for a discretionary activity status for buildings so that effects can be appropriately investigated and assessed. I note that I have read the consent order on Chapter 28, Natural Hazards, and the changes made to Chapter 28 through that order do not alter my recommendations. For Matt and Yuko Bonefield, I have recommended that the BRA be removed, but that the zone remains as medium density residential, not high density residential, as requested by the submitter, due to the site being largely identified as having moderate landscape sensitivity. For Totally Tourism, the submitter requested that BRAs extend further to protect their established flight path. I consider this as a private issue which the existing consent notices recognise. I have recommended that BRA 1 be removed and that BRA 2 be reduced in size in response to other submissions and my assessment of landscape, social and economic effects. For Arthurs Point Land Trustees, I have recommended that BRA 2 be reduced in size and to just be on the sloped part of the site as per Ms. Malsop's evidence. Additionally, I have recommended that BRA 3 remains to protect the landscape values of the adjacent O&L as directed by Chapter 3. BRA 3 is important in relation to strategic objectives that seek to avoid adverse effects on the landscape and natural character of the district's O&Ls. For Arthur's Point Wood Limited Partnership and QRC Shotover, the submitters both seek amendment to the provisions of the medium density residential zone in relation to building height, and Arthur's Point Wood additionally seek amendments to the density and road setback requirements. I consider the requested amendments will have a significant adverse effect on the landscape values. While used elsewhere in the plan, I do not consider bespoke planning provisions are an effective or efficient way to manage the effects on landscape when, in my view, the medium density residential zone provisions appropriately manage this for the Arthur's Point North area. The Koya Architects. Koya requests a more permissive ground floor area above 100 metres squared in the HDR zone for commercial activities. While I can see that this could have local economic and social benefits, the submitter has not provided sufficient evidence to enable this to be adequately assessed. Specifically, at what point the GFA would have negative economic effects on other centres. Without this, I am unable to recommend a threshold and criteria that would be appropriate for a restricted discretionary activity status. Coronet Peak Properties. I have recommended a split HDR and MDR at the base of Mount Dewar, as this provides a legible edge for the HDR zone development and allows for effects on landscape values to be better managed by providing the less dense development on the slope while still allowing the landowner to develop their land. And lastly, Goldstream Properties Limited. The submitter seeks their property to be rezoned Operative District Plan Rural Visitor Zone. The submission particularly opposes the rural zone O&L as notified, which I've not recommended a change to, and Goldstream Properties did not provide any landscape or planning evidence. I consider the Operative District Plan Rural Visitor Zone to be an inappropriate zone for the area and agree with the assessment of the ODP RVZ in the Section 32 report. The landscape assessment by Ms. Malsop identified part of the site as having high landscape sensitivity and noted where an appropriate O&L boundary should be positioned. While I rely on Ms. Malsop's assessment for the landscape sensitivity and location, my view is that the most appropriate zone to protect the landscape values in the way that is directed by the strategic objectives is the rural zone.
Thank you, Ms. Turner. Just a few points of clarification. First, arising out of your summary, the things that occurred to me as you were reading your summary, you may have dealt with your evidence, but because I haven't had time to go back and check that, I'll just ask you to point out where it's dealt with, if it is. In terms of the Stewart submission, I'm clear about what your recommendation is as to zoning. What about the O&L boundary?
Oh, sorry. So my recommendation, I don't know if I've noted that in my rebuttal, actually. But I'm happy with the landscape evidence of Ms. Malsop and her assessment of that. That landscape isn't an issue that I'm worried about with the site. It's more hazards that I'm concerned with.
Now, I have in front of me, Kat, can you pull up the notified plan maps, stage 3, and highlight Arthur's Point North area?
Mr. Chairman, can I just check with Ms. Turner, when she says in the beginning of her evidence that, or summary, figure 9 of her 42A report shows her recommended zoning and overlays.
Mm-hmm.
But so I'm just struggling with 42A, figure 9, is Coronet Property.
So it should be on page 23 of my...
Oh, okay, yes. So there's figure 9 in the text, and then there are further figures in the appendix. That's where I was looking.
Yes,
oh,
so two figure 9s.
Yeah, thank you. And presumably, and you haven't, apart from some, you haven't changed many of the provisions. So the only changes to the provisions are attached to your evidence in chief to the high density.
Yes, that's correct.
And the rest is as notified.
Yes, and the MDR and the HDR were both part of stage
right,
one,
yeah.
So we're notified.
Yeah, so, but the rest of the amendments that might be needed is all in the notified provision.
Yes, yeah, so we didn't notify any provisions in relation to Arthur's Point. It was
okay,
just
the
zoning.
All right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Is that where you're after?
Yes, it is.
Question is, Ms. Turner, I'm looking at this and in terms of the key, I can see the boundary of the O&L as it goes around that, say, blob on the right-hand side of the Stewart property, part along the state highway, then up the side of the Arthur's Point Woods property. There's no O&L boundary, as I can see it, at the top of the Arthur's Point Woods boundary.
That wasn't notified because that was came out of the Stage 1 decisions.
So
we've only notified the boundary where we suggested a change to it from the Stage 1 and 2 decisions?
Yes.
Or 1 decision, sorry.
Yes, that makes sense. Your response and summary to the Courier Architects Commission, no evidence to for a higher threshold. What's the evidence for the existing threshold? Maybe it was that Ms. Hampson dealt with it, but I can't remember.
I am not sure at this stage, I'm sorry, but I can look into that if you'd like.
Can you scribble yourself a note? Because you'll be aware of the case law that says there's no magic in a notified version and no presumption that it's right or any more right than any alternative. So. As I say, come back to me about that, please. Can you answer a point about figure 2 on page 6 of your evidence and cheese, please. As regards the society's submission. I haven't looked up the submission, but I understand the scope point that both you and Ms. Scott have highlighted. But as regards the Arthur's Point North area, where the suggestion as to where the O&L is located is in scope, did the society what did the society seek, if anything, is the zoning for the area outside the O&L boundary?
Just grab this submission so I don't.
Thank you.
So they request that there's further amendments to the location of the proposed medium density residential zone at Arthur's Point to ensure that medium density residential zone is not located within or directly adjoining an ONL, an outstanding natural feature.
So it doesn't sound like they sought anything.
So they didn't request any particular zone, they just requested that the MDR zone was not adjacent. And
just not in, yeah. Mm. We're talking about the Barnfield submission. Mm-hmm. Your comment, the existing smaller lots make this area more urbanised. If those small lots, are they still greenfield or have they been built on?
Yeah, so when I went into the site visit, there's it's quite steep down there, but when I looked, there wasn't any development there.
When was that?
That was when I was writing Section 42A.
So pre-lockdown?
Yes. The only site visit I've done after lockdown was to the Stewart property and to look at the BRA as well, number three.
At 319, looking at, you'd say the stage one BRA is not shown, which is logical, and notified a located over land not notified in stage three. So can you tell me where it is? I think I can guess where it probably is.
Yeah.
But
am I able to bring it up on the map? Is that, can I just?
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
So it's on the screen behind you, just in that little part. Do you want me to come up and point it out? Or?
Yes, I can see the BRA. So in effect, the notified stage three pinches to a point, and it's the extension, the box that sits around the point of the triangle.
Yes, so that was part of stage one.
Basically around the RA2. Or our BRA2. Next question, rising from your 42A report, is 4.12. When you say regional land transport plan contains funding, presumably you don't mean that literally. It's not like a mattress with a large number of dollars under it, or a plan with a large number of dollars sitting under it. What do you mean in terms of the plan contains funding? Okay. Who is paying for it and how committed is that funding?
And if it's a mattress, can you point me to it?
Yes, that too.
So the regional land transport plan, I guess, gives an indication that the replacement bridge is going, is progressing, and it's in, similar to other projects that would be incorporated in the regional land transport strategic kind of projects. The funding's probably just a poor choice.
How committed is that funding, is the question. Particularly in a post-COVID world when everybody's priorities are being readjusted.
I'm not sure that I can answer how committed the writers of the plan are.
Please do.
I'd love to if I could, but I'm sorry.
Okay. You said that hearings to date said the transport issues shouldn't be viewed as an impediment. That was in the context of the shotover bridge. We were talking congestion. The Edith Cavell is quite a different beast. And do you think the comparison is apt?
Do I think the comparison is apt? I think the comparison is still able to be applied here. There's a lot of upgrades in terms of the bus system and other internal things for Arthurs Point North, that even though Edith Cavell is a one-lane bridge rather than the Shotover Bridge being a two-lane bridge, there are other ways to manage the transport impacts without I think are very similar to the Shotover Bridge.
Go to 5.1, you refer to the entirety of Lot 7 DP 520106. Once again, can you point out for me which property is that? For posterity. So that's the Lot 7. Fine.
It looks like a sock.
The boot.
Another boot.
That's helpful, because that's the one I circled and put a question mark next to. The question in terms of your recommendation is recommend the BRA be removed, the whole of the site remaining MDRZ and the VASZ extended to cover the site as shown. And so as shown on figure 9, the question is, I don't think figure 9 does show where the VASZ would go.
Yes. So it is a little bit confusing because the VA subzone is an overlay. So where it's speckled, that's the VA subzone.
going, where is it speckled? I can't see the speckles. Maybe it's my dodgy eyesight.
Okay, are you able to put the figure 9 on?
I suppose the
It's got VASZ written over them in the relevant blobs, but not so the only bit that isn't is the ones to the right there, and it doesn't need to be over the high density.
Yes. So the question is, to the extent that the VASZ extends beyond the Bionfield submission, what's the scope for doing that?
So there were a number of submissions that sought the whole area be rezoned up to HDR, which I consider kind of the VA subzone is between the medium density residential and the high density residential because it makes visitor accommodation more permissive.
Thank you. In relation to your rebuttal, I'm interested in your logic in relation to the Stewart property. Question I have for you, or the observation I'd make in relation to your logic at 3.2 of your rebuttal, is that they're all fair points, but is the end point you reach consistent with the council having approved a 30-lot subdivision on the immediately adjacent site?
So the original consent for the adjacent site was done under the Operative District Plan Rural Visitor Zone. So I think this consent actually demonstrates some of the failings of that operative district plan zoning rather than being inconsistent with my recommendation.
What sort of activity status would the subdivision and the subsequent buildings have been on that site under the operative zoning?
So the decision on that said that it was a restricted discretionary overrule.
Were natural hazards one of the matters of discretion?
The natural hazards chapter in the PDP wouldn't have been considered at that time. The consent documentation has that it was considered under Rule 15.2.10.1, and in reading the geotechnical report, they for the site specific stuff, they did recommend they found that the hazard was dormant, and after the question yesterday, Rob Bond just kind of reiterated his point in his rebuttal that said even though that happened for that site, you would still want to do it for any new development on this the Robert Stewart property.
And the question would be, if it were MDR, would that permit or would that not permit consideration of natural hazards in the same way?
So if it was just zoned MDR, then they could do buildings as of right. The proposal from Mr. Vivian suggests an RD criteria. However, if you put a MDR zone on top of a known hazard with a risk that we know exists without further investigation. My view is that it does indicate that urban development is appropriate on that site, where after further investigations, the site might not be appropriate for urban development. So that is where I think that the rural zone is more appropriate, because it does not indicate that urban development is appropriate for the site to start with, and that provides a discretionary regime for the submitter to put in a consent if they wanted to, but it wouldn't be indicated generally that the urban development is appropriate. It would be a site-specific thing.
I think that when I talked to Mr. Bond about these issues yesterday, he rather shifted position from development might be possible, which suggests possible but unlikely, to that the hazard might preclude development, which suggests likely but possibly not. On the basis that the whole district is hazard prone, and that in some areas have multiple hazards, do you think it's that degree of concern that it might not be appropriate, having against a background where there's been a site-specific analysis next door and found the hazard is dormant, and you're sitting on the same hazard? Like, I didn't press Mr. Bond as to how likely it was, but on the face of it, I was somewhat quizzical, can I say. Do you think that that's a sufficient doubt, given there's now some landscape evidence that the O&L doesn't, like, if you accept that the O&L has to go above Arthur's Point Woods because you've already consented that subdivision, which seems to be the only basis on which the O&L has shifted up, so that to have a logical landscape separation, can't have a straight line down. So it's not a landscape issue. Do you think that is a sufficient doubt that, provided that there is scope carved out of the policies and rules that would apply to turn it down if they can't come up with a suitable hazard fix, not to rezone?
Yes, I think there is sufficient doubt in the hazard risk, and my recommendation is not to rezone it.
I understand. Thank you. I was interested by your logic, so the combination of a BRA and a BASZ, not something that's present elsewhere, it's sort of internally contradictory. Is it any more contradictory than an MDZ zone and a BRA?
My view on that is that because of the existing activities at that property, it's not a rural type activity. So
Can I ask what are the existing activities in those buildings or on the site?
That was going to be my next question.
As far as I'm aware, there's a caretaker on site and there has been some visitor accommodation undertaken.
And do they use that heritage building?
Yes.
Like it sounds like it's being, to the extent that it's being used, it's more, if you're going to recognise the existing activities in the existing buildings, it sounds more like a VASC than a pure residential zone. I suppose the essence is BRA precludes any more development. It doesn't matter what those buildings are used for. The existing ones.
If it was, we're just looking at the activities in those buildings, then I would agree that a VA subzone would be appropriate. It's just the weird way that the BRA is. The purposes, I guess, of the BRA and the visitor accommodation are not the same. So BRA to reduce activities or buildings on the site, and then VA subzone to increase activities on the site. But as a general view, I don't have a problem with visitor accommodation activities on the site.
Okay, thank you.
Can I just follow on from that a wee bit?
Well, I've finished, so follow on to your heart's content.
I mean, without a VASC on that site, but also having the MDR zone, visitor accommodation would be a non-complying activity, wouldn't it, outside of VASC?
Just double check.
But outside of VASC in a medium density zone, visitor accommodation, other than residential stay, is non-compliant.
Yes, so it's the residential visitor accommodation, restricted discretion.
Yes, but that's just in a house. Following on from Chair's line of questioning, a medium density residential zone would allow lots more buildings on that site if it wasn't the BRA. So the BRA sort of cuts across that. It would have to be a whole lot of apartments or something in the existing building. And that would be allowed under an MDR. But the existing use, which seems to be a reasonably rational use for those buildings, would be non-compliant. Mm. Doesn't that seem to be, although I can see what you mean about them being contradictory, given that it is a BRA, so that's quite a strong control, wouldn't enabling the existing uses of those buildings, rather than a change to apartments, say, be a reasonable proposition?
I think so.
Because the main thing there is no more buildings, and the BRA covers there. Mm. Alright, thank you. That's all my questions.
Mr. McLeod?
No questions, just a that haven't already been answered. Just in a future reference, and your and this probably goes to the commissioner's little dots on the map, and I was looking at figure 8 of your evidence in chief, and it's got the pink lines indicate 5 metre contours and the orange lines indicate 1 metre contours. I couldn't tell pink from orange, or it's just future reference basically. No further questions, thanks very much.
Just on the figure 8, yesterday there was a question of Ms. Malsop on the height of that knoll, and that figure does contain that information. It's a bit hard to see on screen, but the top 5 metre contour is 470, and then there's a few 1 metre contours above that. I understand a printed copy, it might not be as easy to see.
And what's the surrounding land?
450.
What's that?
450.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tim, for your assistance.
Thank you.
Next we have Mr. Farr. He has provided evidence, I'll just introduce while we swap over, but he has a section 42A on the energy and utilities variation, and has also provided rebuttal evidence on the universal developments rezoning submission. Just before we, before I hand over to Mr. Barr, in the minute, the information request, Mr. Chair, you have asked for a copy of the deed between Universal and the Council that is subject to a confidentiality clause, and we cannot provide that.
I understand. Well, I'll discuss that with Mr. Hocking. One of the Universal witnesses relies on what it says.
Mr. Williams refers to it in one paragraph.
Yes, and says Mr. Hocking will deal with it, and he doesn't.
I have seen that, and I think there will be some communication with the Universal Developments before they appear.
I'd be obliged that I think the suggestion would be there's going to be a problem if they're going to rely on it, and we can't see it.
Certainly. We can make, of course, the decision and the consent available. Just while Mr. Barr gets sorted, in terms of the request about the Waitapuna maps, it happens that Ms. Turner is one of our gurus at sorting that type of thing, so she wouldn't have seen it, the information request yet, but Ms. Pickard and Ms. Turner are going to have a chat this morning about the timing. I have been advised we can provide the first request, which is the Togo maps overlaid, certainly before Tuesday, even this afternoon possibly. It just might be a little bit more complex around the MASL requirements, but I'm reasonably confident we'll have that to you by before Tuesday.
That would be of considerable assistance. I don't think we need it before Tuesday, because I think that as submitters, particularly lay submitters, come through, it would be useful to have that available to us. So,
to cover energy and utilities first. They're quite separate topics.
They are indeed. That might be more logical. So we'll do universal developments as a discrete issue.
Thank you.
Okay. With respect to the variation to Chapter 30, energy and utilities, I consider the variation to Chapter 30, Energy and Utilities, will improve certainty, generate a reduction in potential cost transactions with regard to plan implementation, the relationship between utilities and other PDP chapters, the partially operative regional policy statement, and introduce a clearer and more certain consenting pathway for natural hazard mitigation activities. With regard to recommended rule 3157, which relates to stormwater management and the potential for bird strike, at Queenstown and Wanaka airports. In my Section 42A report, I adopted the aircraft approach and protection measures, figures 1 and 3. I note that Queenstown Airport Corporation have not provided any additional information in relation to maps that may more precisely identify the zone of influence in relation to where a stormwater management area requires intervention to manage effects from potential bird strike on aircraft operations at Queenstown or Wanaka airports. I also note that I omitted to attach the figures 1 and 3 as appendices to my Section 42A report, but these are existing in the planning maps and they're all also identified in the advice note to that rule that was drafted in my Section 42A report.
Is there a separate portal for those stray things like those designation maps? Of course, the viewer is just one map. There is no. So you're talking about.
Yeah, that's right. At the moment, you'll need to go to the PDF version of the consolidated maps, and at the very bottom of the list of PDF maps, there's the Queenstown and Wanaka Airport. Approach slopes and also the.
They're attached to someone else's evidence on glare.
Yes, Ms. Glory's.
Ms. Glory's
okay.
Evidence, yes.
Yeah.
Because she's there with glare and a glare submission from Queenstown as well.
So
she attaches.
I wonder whether.
Oh, maybe not all of them.
Rather than me poking around making sure I can find it. Ms. Scott, can you just supply us with the link to those documents?
Certainly.
She only has Queenstown, actually. She doesn't have Wanaka.
Certainly, yeah. And I can tell you where they are because I have to go looking for them. They are, so they sit on the plan maps. So in terms of the stage 1 and 2, decision maps. So the PDFs.
Oh, consolidated decision maps. Go down the page.
But if you go right to the bottom.
Yes, understand. I knew they were around because I went looking for those individual maps.
So they are they're part of the designation.
Yeah, but if this is something we've used that's been an issue for some other purpose. In effect, they've got to be in this chapter. A copy of those maps have got to be in this chapter because the designation might change.
That's correct. We may have mentioned that in the Section 42 report as well, and one thing that I think that was your idea. That I agonised briefly over as well was that to simply reproduce those maps in a schedule to Chapter 30, or to rely on the maps as they exist. I was sort of more concerned with paper and efficiency, but bearing in mind the consideration of the designation might change and have a consequence to that rule, and also the problem we just had with perhaps not finding the layer in the online web map of these. Perhaps if the rule is recommended to be approved, then they are attached as a schedule to the chapter.
Yes, well, I could see that there will be, for instance, no PDF decisions map for this stage. And you could imagine that that whole entire set being quietly lost.
But Mr. Barr, you've also said that you're just using those maps because they're there and they seem vaguely sort of on the right track. But you've also suggested that if the airport wanted, they could come back with some more precise information about where bird strike is actually an issue.
That's right, and to be fair, I had a reasonable expectation that was the case, and that was going to happen. I had an offline conversation with consultants for Queenstown Airport, and they were discussing that too, but that didn't materialise, so we have what we have at the moment.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now, well, going through your evidence on this, the chapter 30 minutes, they're all quite detailed. First of all, dealing with policy 30.2.9.3. Have I got this right? It starts at your 4.8. If I got this right, this is just a drafting issue. Everybody's actually seeking to say the same thing. It's just how. What is the best way to say it?
Yes, and it's just certainty that
yeah.
in what the context.
The issue with any encouraged policy is what exactly is the course of action that it is committing the council to, or committing the uses of the plan to. And is this, are you actually encouraging works? Well, maybe there's no scope to change anyway, but for my edification, are you actually encouraging works to be of, I think you said late in your rebuttal you said delete the no, just say of low residual risk, or is it, if you've got the choice, take the option that means low residual risk?
I think it comes back to the fact that the activity needs a resource consent and it's a discretionary resource consent, and the concept of a low or no, if it's possible, but the concept of low residual risk is the ideal. So I think it's a helpful policy, and you're right just on the first point about the policy saying encourage. I think it imposes a positive obligation on both the council as a consent authority and the applicant to investigate or to design natural hazard mitigation so that a low residual risk is the outcome, and that's the ideal. As I said before, it's through the lens of a discretionary activity resource consent. So I think in that context, the policy's quite helpful, and it has a place to help frame the consideration of those types of activities, the consideration of resource consent applications for natural hazard mitigation.
So if we had a free hand to you in terms of what this is trying to do, it is require a reduction in residual risk and aim for a low outcome.
Yes.
Saying don't increase natural hazards or sort of do the whip sponge, poke it here and it pops out there.
Perhaps the policy could be used in the context too, because part of that variation is framed around acknowledging the functional need for natural hazard mitigation to occur in sensitive environments. So
Or maybe even enable hazards structures and works that reduce natural hazard risk.
Perhaps, but then enable could be construed as having a different type of activity status or an obligation to grant the consent irrespective of other tensions that you might have.
Okay. Again, 3295. What's the action that recognise means, that recognise would produce?
It's part of the, it forms part of the decision making framework that natural hazard mitigation is likely to be located in an outstanding natural landscape or outstanding natural feature, especially if it involves water or flood management activities. So it's so the policy by no means seeks to override the policies that you'd also engage in Chapter 30, Energy and Utilities, and Chapter 6, in terms of landscape management, if you needed to. So the concept there around recognition is, while it's not a particularly sort of strong verb or statement that requires something to be done, it's forms part of this decision-making guidance really around the issues and tensions you can have with natural hazard mitigation activities.
So in terms of the discussion I was having yesterday, I'm not sure it was with Ms. Grace, but of the general policies that say that development in O&Ls generally is inappropriate, this would be a counterpoint saying recognise that these things are going to be happening.
Yes. Yes, and it says recognise purposefully and not enable or provide for, because the policy isn't designed to be stronger than perhaps other policies that protect landscape or other natural resources.
Can you remind me what the number of in Chapter 3 of the revised O&L policy is? It's got an X on it.
There you go. 325XX for the O&L.
Gotcha. Yeah. Thank you. Now, in relation to the discussion of the QAC submission on Rule 30.3.3.5, I was reading 5.8 and I was going in slow circles trying to understand what you meant. And I eventually thought that maybe you had it round the wrong way around. Because if something is not a utility as defined, it's going to fall outside Chapter 30 anyway.
Yes.
So the question is, well, the issue would be if there are any utilities that 3335 doesn't cover and that are properly managed by the import zone. And I don't know the answer to that. Can you think of any?
Not really. So the concept of utility being governed by chapter 17, or the airport zone chapter rather than chapter 30, with the exception of the airport itself and the airport activities itself. Not really, and I think that's my point. I think what you put to me in your first sentence was somehow better framed than what I tried to say in 5.8 from the sounds of it. And what I may have said or may have inferred as well is that I think it's also fundamentally up to that activity or the proponent of that activity to just about elect if they want to choose to be utility in a certain circumstance. The definition of utility in the PDP is quite broad. It's not as, let's say, strict as the definition in the Act or any sort of other district plans might have a prerequisite that you're a registered network utility operator or something like that. The definition in the PDP is quite broad.
I go horribly confused by your discussion in chapter or section 6 of the numbering, because you've got proposed rules, but it still cross-references rule 30.5.1e, and that rule doesn't exist. Well, that number doesn't exist.
No, and it should cross-reference back to 7 the way it was drafted. Or the way it was notified. So the reference to E should be 7, I understand.
So it should be 30.5.1.7 in your, literally the last line of your box on page 14.
Yes.
In terms of your discussion at 6.16, I'll just write that down. Give me a second. It occurred to me that another problem with ORC's suggested matters of discretion is that they don't give effect to the RPS policy about preferring risk management to hard structures, which is 4.1.10.
Yes, that's correct. Amongst potentially many other things.
Indeed, amongst a whole row of other things.
Mm.
But I just thought it was ironic. But given the ORC's keenness for everything to be brought into line with their RPS. Lastly, we need to look at your literally the last point, the definition of municipal infrastructure. You don't provide for CCOs. Well, as far as I'm aware, it obviously doesn't have any at the moment. Should it? Is that sufficiently possible that it should be provided for at this point?
No. If no, and the reason for that is because it would be straining with the definition that fell out of the regional policy statement. And because of any uncertainty as if a CCO were formed, let's say for water infrastructure or for another type of infrastructure. They still may, the way that, now I could be wrong here because I know there's a large presence in other local authorities, but the way the CCO was formed, it could still rely on that definition if it was, let's say, controlled or instructed by the council perhaps.
Like if the CCO is managing council assets, that's right, but so, but some CCOs take over the whole kit and caboodle.
Mm.
As I say, it's just a question. If you don't think it's necessary and it's restraining the RPS, that's fine.
Yes, it's certainly not necessary, at least at the moment.
That's all I have on Chapter 30. Commissioner Dawson?
No question.
Nothing
for me next. All right, well, let's talk about the rest.
Okay, Universal Developments. At 3, I recommend the rezoning submission should be rejected unless there is greater certainty that the identified infrastructure constraints, and in particular roading, are resolved. While I consider my recommended suite of policies and rules that would effectively require consideration of key infrastructure matters once more than 500 lots have been created as appropriate and would be effective, a more efficient outcome may be that there is an agreement between the council and the developer to facilitate and cost share infrastructure. However, I am not aware of any such proposal beyond what may have been agreed as part of the resource consent obtained under the HESHA legislation, which only applies to a limited part of the rezoning proposal. Notwithstanding the above, there remains a potentially significant constraint identified by Mr. Smith in relation to the requirement to take land at the intersection of Cemetery and Domain Road to facilitate intersection improvements. I also consider that an urban extension to the south of Cemetery Road could be appropriate. However, any new urban extension must have an effective urban edge, defendable urban growth boundary. I also maintain the extent of any urban extension to the south of Cemetery Road should be commensurate with the nature and scale of Lake Harbour Township and environs, even taking into account the PDP zoning of low-density suburban residential over much of the existing Lake Harbour Township. I have one identified error that's worth pointing out. That's at and it's probably quite obvious, it's at paragraph 3.3 on page 4 of my rebuttal, and the second to last sentence where I say this amount of LDSR lots is in the order of 500 metres squared, less than that supported by Mr. Williams. We can delete the M2. So it's not about the area, it's just 500. I'm also happy now to talk through the structure of the provisions I've recommended, in particular the affordable housing, just in terms of the mechanics rather than the merits, but if there'll be questions on that, I'm happy to talk that through as part of when you land on that as well.
We might ask you to take us through that, but before we do that, guide, because I sat in the hearing, it's on the public record in 2002, where a senior engineer in contact told a hearing panel that the assessed probability of the Gladstone Gap being overtopped was in excess of 100,000 to 1. And that was the basis why Contact hadn't applied for a resource consent to do that. So on that basis, as I say, that's on the record, if anyone's interested. I can find the decision. It records that.
I think that's in the evidence somewhere. I knew that it was from reading someone's evidence that it was an enormous number.
And so the question is, do you think a risk of 100,000 to 1 is something that is going to stop anything happening in the future, or in excess of that? How reliable is that flood hazard as a deterrent about urban expansion to the east?
No, it's not. And I think without having any knowledge of the particular reasons as to why it was deemed to be appropriate when under the operative rural residential zone, what is now the large lot A zone is also has development over the influence of that flood hazard. And effectively, I understand the submitter's hazard specialist's evidence to say the same, at least only as it relates to that site, though, to the parts of the rezoning site that are under the influence of the
I think it was because the risk was assessed as being higher in the 90s, and it was reassessed. In terms of your point, is there an additional consideration to bring to bear that the whole enabling character of the SHA, that we're operating with a different set of guidelines, a different set of priorities that would suggest that we shouldn't treat what's in an SHA consent as gospel for RMA purposes, basically?
No, not at all. No, completely different legislative framework for decision makers.
Just wondering, can you remind me what the elapsed date on those SHA versions are? Because they're shorter, aren't they, than our RMA terms?
I think it depends on what's in the consent, isn't it?
Yes, and I don't know, but I know that...
Which is why I've asked for a copy of the consent.
Yes. And Mr. Williams, who's sitting behind me, will definitely know, but they are quite short. It might be in the order of
two years. I've seen some of them have been 2 years.
Yeah, that's...
I'll try and find that while
can you explain the red underline and strikeout, because there are some that's underlined, some which I wonder whether it's supposed to be struck out, but it is underlined, because maybe that's because the lines are the wrong place. I can go back to the original, but is...
Yes,
And what's the red text that's neither underlined nor struck out?
So with policy 3217,
yeah.
I think it's safe to underline the red according to one or more of. Hold on.
No,
significant strikeout. Sorry.
That the stuff that's not underlined should be struck
out. Yep. Strikeout.
Yes. That the strikeout hasn't come through.
Yeah, that's right, Commissioner. And strikeout protect with policy 328. 18.
Strike out the whole of that second A.
Oh, so it's... Gotcha. So, so
yes.
The rule of thumb is strike out the stuff that's not actually marked.
If it's red but not otherwise marked.
Okay. All good.
It would be worth getting a cheat.
That's a damn shame. The other A would have been handy.
Now, 3.16. I'd like to ask the hypothetical question. Putting aside the SHA consent, because as far as I'm aware, it hasn't been exercised yet. Looks like Domain Acres is being exercised. The ground certainly been prepared. Looks like the roads are in when we were there. The hypothetical question is, if Hawea is going to expand, which is a big if in itself, do you consider that there is a sensible alternative other than going south of Cemetery Road? Is this an issue of timing only? Or is there a sensible alternative?
No, I don't think there is at a broad scale, I don't think there is a more appropriate alternative. In broad terms, the land to the east towards the Grandview Range contains soils that would be considered significant under the current regional policy statement. And the land to the west or southwest is pretty much at the Hawea River, and there's a council, I don't know how long a life it has, but there's, you know, council infrastructure such as the wastewater facility for Hawea at the moment.
So there'll be all manner of hail issues about that anyway, even if it closed down.
I guess if it's closed down, it can be decommissioned and they can be overcome depending on the type of development. It's more about perhaps the council, I don't know the answer to this, but hypothetically the council strategically might want to
keep it
and more land around it for infrastructure purposes. You also have, without stepping into the shoes of a landscape architect, you might have some sensitivities as you get closer to the Hawea River, even if it's not an ONL, it's... It has natural character. It may have high or
it's
at least natural character.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Sort of
sandwiched.
On the other
yeah.
side of Domain Road, it's still quite a narrow strip.
Yeah.
And safe to assume that it has cultural issues given what we heard at the start of the hearing.
Yeah.
Yes, and a large area of land is owned by Contact Energy, who might have their own views on what should or shouldn't happen there.
Just an observation. As far as 3.21, the original idea was that this was going to be an Upper Clutha specific policy. Removing reference to local demand, I can understand why that might be a good idea. But is this now generic? This is, given that an identical policy the Wakatipu?
Yes, there's not much between them at all.
Discussion of proposed local shopping centre zone. I can understand the argument about scope to expand the lower density housing area, which has been notified over the road, or over the road and along the road. But what's the scope to put in a local shopping centre zone? In terms of the discussion I had with Ms. Scott about scope, and that this is consequential and incidental to the residential zoning over the road. In terms of, it's not whether Universal sorted, because their submission was so general it could have covered any selection of urban zones, but in terms of whether it's on the plan change.
Same in the notified Albert Town provisions, did they add the local shopping centre zone as part of that? That was part of an earlier stage, wasn't it?
I think there was an earlier stage of the plan with the review of the
yes.
what was the corner shopping centre?
Yeah, so the corner shopping centres,
yeah.
Even in the settlement zones,
old
township zones,
were done in stage one.
Were done in a previous stage, and it was only the residential that rolled over in Albert Town.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, if setting aside the issue of, let's presume that Universal Developments have asked for a local shopping centre zone or some type of commercial activity as part of their submission, in the context of this being sort of consequential in terms of a similar type of urban extension to an existing reviewed area over the road, it's probably more of a nuanced legal issue, but in the context of the development being, and the scale, probably comes back to the scale of what Universal Developments seek in terms of complementary local shopping and convenience activities. So it's not beyond the realms to contemplate a zone that specifically caters for locals' convenience and retail needs.
Obviously, I'll take it up with Universal, but it seems something of a bootstraps position, basically, because their particular consequential addition is so large, then local shopping centre is in turn consequential on the consequential.
Mm.
I mean, would the owner of the existing shopping centre zone in Hawea that was rezoned in a historical stage have even bothered to look at this submission, given that they thought that those zones were already done and dusted?
If they'd looked, they wouldn't have known anyway. It's not a matter of looking at the
submission.
It's not a matter of looking at the summary. Even if you read the submission, you wouldn't know.
Yeah. I mean, but they mightn't even bother because they thought, oh, well, those zones have been done. This is just can only be about residential stuff.
This is something to Ms. Scott to say, but you know, the unique circumstances as to which the council didn't oppose some rezoning submissions because you know they were on that zone does bring that into question. It probably doesn't help you, but I'm slightly more relaxed about the local shopping centre zone in terms of its relationship with a relatively large residential urban expansion. I don't support the general industrial zone as it stands, but I think that's something where there's, in terms of your question, there's a lot more doubt.
Well, ironically, the GIS is firmly on stage three.
That is, sorry, that doesn't matter then. Yes, that's fine. So that was, that you're right.
That's more a merits issue.
Yes, and because that zone is being reviewed, then it's a different issue. But if it was about the its relationship with a sort of consequential urban extension, that would seem greyer to me. But it's not.
Okay, thank you. Same problem that I've already discussed with Ms. Scott of relying on a deed that you can't give me and tell me what it actually says. So,
So, that's right.
Don't breach the confidentiality.
No, I haven't.
Not asking you to do that.
No, that's easy. I think I nearly said something the other day that did that, but I haven't been involved in the SHA at all, so I'm quite safe to say I know nothing about it or the deed, which is good because that's why I've focused on the provisions, and I'm not sure if Mr. Williams' evidence is focusing on or relying on the consented part to. The consented SHA to deal with the whatever agreement the council have with the developer there, but I've sort of focused broader and in terms of seeing some of those positive aspects come through in the provision, so I'm not too concerned about the deed.
Right, I think I'll ask my colleagues if they've got any questions, and then I'll ask you to take us through the plan provisions and for you to highlight anything you want to draw to our attention.
Right, I have quite a few questions, and I definitely want to go through the provisions, but it'll be best to do that at the end. Are we about to have a pause at all?
We could have a pause if you would like. Oh, sorry, time flies when you're having fun.
Excuse me, Commissioner, I do have the decision and consent in front of me, and I can forward it on now if that would assist.
I suspect that we're not going to be able to absorb it. Just tell me what the lab state is.
The lab state, okay, it is. I just moved off that. Not possibly going to help, but the lab state for stage one is 3 years from the date of the decision, which I'll go back to in a moment. And the lab state for stages 2A, 2B, 3A, and 3B are 5 years from the date of the decision, which is 20th of April, 2020.
Yes.
Is each stage reliant on the other? So if stage one doesn't go ahead and lapses, the others can?
Look, I'm not familiar. I wasn't involved in this at all. But the way that is worded, it refers specifically to a stage rather than them being linked together.
But there may be other conditions that link the two.
Yeah.
There may be. And I also I'd have to have a look at the stages in detail. There's someone sitting behind me who knows a lot more about it.
Yes. Well, on that happy note, we'll take 10 minutes today. We'll come back at 10:45.
I'm freezing. Yeah, I'm starting to shake.